Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. So, Trishul, I don't think I've told you this little nugget about myself, but I really like reading, especially in bed as I go to sleep. It's been one of the better ways that I've been able to kind of calm my brain down, at least going back to high school. I've always had a reading light next to my bed, and it's just been one of the things I have really done consistently throughout my life. And a few years ago, several years ago, maybe before COVID now, it's kind of years are blurring together. But my wife has asked me to read on my Kindle more instead of having my light on. So I've been reading on my Kindle, I think it's called a Kindle Paperwhite, that has a backlight, because I can read just fine. I can turn the brightness down pretty low. It's much easier on the eyes than like a phone screen. And my wife has no problem sleeping next to me. And for a while, I was kind of looking at books to check out from the library on my Kindle. And I was still kind of had an older mentality of like, okay, I have these books that I want to read, but I don't want to just spend money like if I already have the book. So sometimes I'd be like reading somewhere else. And probably the example I thought of recently is with Harry Potter. My wife and I, we read Harry Potter. And so from about the fifth book on, books 5, 6, and 7, we bought the book as soon as it came out because we have hardcovers of that. I happen to have a hardcover of the first one. And so we had hardcovers of the first one and 5, 6, 7, and paperbacks of 2, 3, 4. Like, well, when we look at the shelf, I want to see like all the hardcovers. So at one point I bought hardcovers of books 2, 3, and 4. Then the last few years, they came out these really cool illustrated books. Like they're much bigger. So it's probably like a 14-inch square, maybe 16 by 16. Like it's a big square. So it doesn't have to be as thick. And you open up some really amazing paintings. Not every page, but some of the pages will have like a double layout. Some of the pages will be text on one side, amazing painting on the other. And after reading to the kids, I've liked reading through the book I hold in my hand. And I often remember the original stories. They have little artwork at the beginning of each chapter, but kind of comparing that artwork to these really amazing paintings as the kids read along. And I've been like, I want to get back to reading Harry Potter because it's been a while since I've read some of these stories. But all my reading time's at night. And so I'm now thinking like, do I buy these Harry Potter books on my Kindle for the fourth time? Do I pay for them for the fourth time just to be able to read them on my Kindle? And I couldn't really come up with a good reason not to. It's part of like, I have been really enjoying books by Brandon Sanderson, a few other business books that kind of are something that kind of help with my business and the way that I help clients. Reading Lasting Coaching, Brief Coaching for Lasting Impact. Also, I don't actually remember the title. That's probably not a good sign, but Brief Coaching. And I do enjoy readings on my Kindle. And I've, at some point in the last year or two, something switched where I have no problem paying whatever the price is to buy my book on the Kindle. And I think I wanted to kind of talk about that with you today. This idea of like, at what point, like, was it my business had gotten to a point where I have enough clients, my revenue's up, and so my personal income's a little bit up? Is it prioritizing my kind of time and energy? And I think that's what I want to kind of talk about. Like, when is it okay to spend more? Not just from like a pure numbers perspective, but almost like a mentality shift. So before we kind of go down that path, like, do you have any story like that of something that you kind of spent money on that you would not have in the past?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, you know, with the Harry Potter Kindle example. And I think a good part of just how I think when it comes to money and spending has always kind of been, okay, you know, this product is something that I'm interested in. Let me find what's the most efficient way to get it. You know, efficient means, you know, most often what's the least amount you can pay for the most amount of product and whatnot. And it's strange because sometimes when I used to go into like a grocery store, I used to, you know, look at the per ounce or whatever per whatever calculation they give. And of course, those have tons of mistakes. So you kind of sometimes have to do the math yourselves and stuff like that. And then you're just doing this weird type of optimization algorithm on, okay, this is the better brand, but this is slightly cheaper per ounce. But if I buy twice as much, and it's just interesting that my brain just kind of does it now that it's hard to stop. It's one of those things where I feel like I've been conditioned to do it so much that if I try not to do it, it's hard to not do it without actively thinking. So it is strange. Like even when you mentioned the Kindle for Harry Potter, I just quickly typed it into my browser. And it turns out you can get Harry Potter for free on Kindle if you have a Prime membership.
Oh, really? Thank you. I haven't actually downloaded it, but that is now exactly what I'm going to do.
Right. And then, you know, I know, for example, you can borrow electronic books sometimes from your library, right?
That's what I did a lot in the past. But it's like I don't know how the library of electronic books works because they only have a certain number of copies. So you still have to wait for someone to return it. So you can't read it immediately.
Yeah. So sometimes there's some barriers and sometimes there's multiple borrowing library apps. So you may have to jump around and then, you know, at a high level, it comes down to, well, what's kind of important here? The adventure of getting the cheapest price or just moving on with your life. Right.
Yeah. It's like when I finish one book and I'm laying in bed and I want to read for another 20 minutes, I don't want to get up and go down to my computer to check out from the library and transfer it to my Kindle. I can buy it on the Kindle while I'm lying in bed.
Yeah. And look, at the end of the day, it's still one of the cheapest forms of entertainment.
Yes. Like my book budget's not going to kill me.
You could do that every day and, you know, and still not run out of money. And it, so, you know, but I definitely one side of the coin is at some point there isn't a real point to it, but I understand the side where there's this long history of conditioning to kind of think in one way. And it can, I guess, become a little challenging to kind of unlearn those habits.
So can you think of something where you, like you almost like consciously told yourself in your brain, no, it's okay to spend more for the convenience, for the better product. Like you're not doing that like true like price value comparison. It's like, that's the thing I want and I want to get that one. And like, it's well within, like you know, it's well within your budget. It's below a certain, like it should not financially impact you at all.
Yeah,
and so you know, frankly, to like let that internal thing go.
Yeah, that is a tough one for me. I got to be honest. Like even like I mentioned the grocery store example, I think my brain is addicted to like optimizing trivial things just because it likes doing it. I think part of me has just kind of given in to say, okay, it's not the worst habit to have on the planet, and sometimes your brain just needs things to do while you're, you know, doing more mundane tasks like picking up groceries and stuff like that. So it is a little tough. And I was at a period in my life where if it wasn't something necessary, it wasn't even on my radar. So I think that's changing a little bit now that I have also more free time. You know, as you mentioned, our businesses have come to the point where it's not on that super early stage where you got to do all of these different things. But, you know, it's like once you get the machine going, it's more maintenance, right? And there's less initial involvement to keep the business alive. You know, it's not on life support or anything like that anymore. So yeah, I'd say I'm being more flexible with my time and my free time, especially when it comes to having to like spend for it. I think certainly over the last few years, different from the previous 10, 20 years, is that we've been taking a lot more trips and stuff like that, buying, you know, tickets to amusement parks and whatnot. You know, I mentioned that I went to Hershey Park maybe like 24 times up in Pennsylvania. Well, the thing here in Florida is we have the whole Disney thing, although we're doing the Legoland stuff now. So we've been there a handful of times already. And, you know, just something where if we have something to do for a weekend, we'll go to a theme park, right? You know, okay. And not think about it so much. But, you know, that's also a little more for my daughter than myself. So it still gets a little tricky when it is just for me. But I have been thinking a little more on ways to keep myself busy with hobbies and stuff. So I did start exploring with little things that I can do on my end. When we went to Legoland, of course, you get inundated with Lego this and that, and you immediately want to buy all the Lego sets. So I did try that. You know, I got one of the Star Wars sets for like Yoda. But then I realized, well, they don't do much after you make them. They're not. They do have like the ones that move and stuff, but they weren't too exciting, I guess. So I found these like these wooden 3D puzzle kits on Amazon, and they seemed a lot more cooler than the Lego. So I started working on those, and they're pretty neat. You put them together, and literally you can make anything, like a robot or one of those things where you have the marbles going around, right?
And okay. Yeah.
It goes through like the ramps and stuff. I just finished one that's a globe, and it really has like all the gears and the spinning globe and the magnifying glass. It's really neat how they create these things. So yeah, I guess you can call that splurging. I don't even know if it okay. Again makes a dent, but that's one thing.
Okay. No, a few years ago, my wife actually bought me one of the Millennium Falcon Lego things. It was,
oh, that's a good one.
3,000 pieces, something like that. So after kids were going to bed, I was actually spending time putting this together over a few weeks. I still kind of have it, but again, I've let the kids play with it, so it's there's definitely some pieces missing. It's not I've never been the so growing up, my brother and I had Legos, and we would make up so many random things. And so we would just like have these buckets, dump them out on the blanket. Cause if you put the blanket, you can pick up the corners and pour the blanket, all the pieces back into the buckets. That was our cleanup strategy. So we would build anything that came to mind. We had a few like kits that we got, but we'd take them apart and use those pieces for other things. And so when I built something for Legos, like, okay, let's take it apart and build something else kind of thing. But I think my kids wanted to keep the things. So my daughter built some things, and at some point, like, pieces were coming off, like, okay, let's take this part. And I think she kind of got upset that I didn't let her keep, like, she built the Hogwarts train, the Hogwarts Express. And, like, it's not really as the thing anymore. I think that might have like disillusioned her. I don't know what happened there, but like it's been one of those things I've had to acknowledge. Like the way I play with Legos, at least as a kid, is different than the way other people do. Like I never kept the things together. It was building and being creative that appealed to me more. But I have to acknowledge that maybe my kids are not the same from that perspective. So yeah, I don't quite have the Millennium Falcon in the same form anymore. But my kids still build Legos sometimes. But they always follow the instructions and build from the kits.
Yeah, I think that may come down to personality. Like, I noticed my daughter doesn't like it when I take apart the things that I build with Legos. Like, she likes the display thing. So it probably comes down to the individual.
Every year, my wife gets me and the three kids a Lego advent calendar. These are pretty cool. Where like each day of December, you pull out a little thing to put together. Sometimes it's just a person, sometimes it's a little robot. But there's been different themed ones. So we really enjoy that as well. But sorry, getting back to your story about like how you have felt comfortable spending money to go to Legoland more often and something else there.
Yeah, so, you know, I read an article recently that kind of brought to light the patterns I've been seeing with my own personal spending over the years and also very recently. The notion of the article, the title, let me just read it. It was The 7 Stages to Financial Freedom. And what it detailed is the different viewpoints that an individual may go through on their path towards financial independence. And it's a different mindset when it comes to spending in each of these categories. When you're early in the path, your relationship with money is far different than when you're well along in that journey or where you're towards the end of that journey. And, you know, I guess it was kind of apropos in how I was recently feeling about my spending. So I did find it interesting. The very first step on that journey is this notion of clarity. And what this kind of means is when you become clear about your financial position and where you want to be. And I mentioned this in some earlier episodes. For me, this was kind of when I first started working. I got that first paycheck and I just started reading about investing and stuff like that and running some numbers on my end. And you know, one of the earlier books, this is 2 decades ago, but have you heard of, oh boy, I'm not going to butcher it, but Rich Dad, Poor Dad, is that
Rich
it?
Rich Dad, Poor Dad, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so the notion in that book was you had the author who his father was poor, and then he had a mentor who was financially successful. He called him his rich father. And he learned about all the mistakes that his father was making versus what the financially independent father was making or not making. And both fathers were working incredibly hard, but one was getting a lot further in life. And it really set this mindset in my head about it's not about working harder. It's about working smarter, right? It's about making these financial steps that provide a compounding over time, right? Starting early and whatnot. So I think that was certainly my first step on this journey. And it's interesting how that they pointed it out that that is the first launch pad of moving towards financial freedom, I would say.
Okay. So I guess that, okay, I think like acknowledging that, at least thinking about it, maybe like the it's almost like it's not quite acknowledging that there's a problem, but it's like that same idea of your say like first the first level of introspection, I guess I'd say that do you want are you just like going along status quo versus I would like to be at some point, at like some better point at some point in the future, just acknowledging that. Does that make sense? But why don't you kind of quite quickly go through, because I think there's some things towards the end that I really want to dig deeper in.
Okay, so yeah, so the initial step is this notion of clarity, just having some understanding that there is a path and there is an ability to get there. But then, you know, then comes the hard work, and right into stage two or level two is this notion of self-sufficiency. And the idea there is it's a level where you can sustain yourself based upon the income you generate, meaning all of the expenses that you incur are covered by your income. You're not dependent on anyone or anything else for survival. It means you're basically living within your means as well. And yeah, this is the notion of you're no longer, you know, living in your parents' basement, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that that's a pretty important step. It's a step that it seems like it's harder for this later generation. That's based upon the numbers we're seeing. People are living at home longer, and there's a lot more debt because of the high cost of education. It's harder to step away because obviously we realize the cost of housing has gone up and rental prices have gone up and so on. So it is a big step to get to this, you know, the second level. But, you know, just kind of moving on that, I'd say each step forward brings you closer towards this notion of just independence. So level three is this notion of breathing room. The idea that you're no longer living paycheck to paycheck, you know, you're still covering yourself, but there's also some buffer so that even if you lose your job, you have an emergency fund for a couple months. And this also means you can save a little bit for the future, like you're starting to put money into retirement accounts. And that is, again, a big distinction between just covering your means. You're also thinking past today. You're planning for the future. So, you know, jumping to the next one, level four is this notion of stability. So at this point, you're probably, you know, later in your career, maybe in the middle of your career, you've got your student loans paid off, you have your emergency fund, you could probably even take a short sabbatical if you want. And if you're at the point of starting a family, you've covered the basics of, you know, covering your children with expenses they may need, you know, maybe starting a college fund and stuff like that. And you're building up your retirement accounts. Things are pretty stable. The notion is if you stay on this path, you'll eventually get to financial independence. It may take a while, but at least you're on that path. Whereas if you're on any of the earlier stages, you'll basically survive, but you'll work forever until you maybe have a de minimis social security check coming in at the end.
Yeah.
So it's really not till level four that you get to the point where you're building enough of a cushion to, you know, frankly, meet your standard 65-year-old retirement age lifestyle. That feels like what a level four means, meaning you got to keep that up until you're about 65 and you'll have a decent chance of retiring in comfort. You know, that maybe 70 is a new 65 now, right? There's been pushed on longevity, which has, you know, pushed off retirement ages. We all know the RMD age went from 71 to 73 for requiring distributions for retirement accounts. Full retirement ages have been increasing. I don't know if you heard this recently, Aaron, but they're talking about changing the RMD age to 75 now.
Oh, no, I haven't. I know they changed to 72, but I did not know they're pushing it up again.
They're not, but I've heard talks of that in some of the latest plans. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, with level four, it seems like you'll kind of get there. But it's interesting. Now at level four, this is like midlife crisis time, I'd say, where people realize, what am I doing with all my time, my limited time here? Should I start spending more now and enjoying my life or before it's too late? I think these are the tough questions that come up in this stage.
Go on, because I think I'm going to come back to that comment. But why don't you go finish up as the context for our conversation.
Okay, so next is level 5. This is known as flexibility, where you're so far along in your career and your life objectives that you could maybe go part-time. You know, you don't need to burn on all cylinders. You've done a good job of savings, and you got to the point where you can be kind of flexible with how you spend your time. You might change careers to a lower stress job. You know, you may stop the overtime. You've come to the point where maybe the kids are moving out and you have less dependence. So you have more flexibility on how you want to live your life. You're not completely financially independent. You still need some sort of income to sustain yourself, but you have a lot more breathing room. And again, that this is also the point where you could change your spending to the point where your discretionary spending can start becoming a larger share of your monthly expenses or annual expenses. You can start throwing in the more grander annual vacations or the more expensive luxury cars and the second homes and stuff like that. I feel like that's what comes with level 5. And, you know, before putting it off for too long, level 6 is financial independence. So this is the notion where your money earns more than you spend, meaning you could live passively off of the income that your money generates. And, you know, the target for, or the common target is 65, right? You want to retire at age 65 where you no longer need to work and your assets can support you throughout your retirement. That is kind of the goal. But in general, this can happen at whatever age it happens at based upon your level of assets and your spending requirements. And being financially independent essentially means that you can spend your time doing what you want to do, and it doesn't necessarily have to be motivated by a financial incentive. However, what this also means at level 6 is you still kind of have to watch your spending. You can't just go off and buy anything you want anytime you want. You have to live within a budget or constraints. So there is a next stage beyond financial independence, and that's this notion of abundant wealth, that's stage 7. And the idea here is there could become there's a tipping point where your wealth grows to the point where it's really hard to spend all of it. It's past this kind of point of no return. It's like a runaway fusion reaction where it's just going to generate more energy no matter what you do. You can't pull away enough energy from the core without causing a meltdown. And the idea there is your compounding rate is so high as compared to your expenses that even if you double or triple your spending, your wealth is still going to go up. And that's the notion of abundant wealth. And that's the final stage on this ladder.
Okay. So thank you for that intro. Thank you for the kind of quick summary. I think the two things I want to talk about, one kind of might be that either that abundant wealth of like, if you don't spend more, your net worth will just keep growing and growing. And the really important caveat here is like, when we say spend more, that could also include donating money or giving it away. It does not have to be actual spending on stuff. But if you don't kind of withdraw enough from your net worth, your foreign investments portfolio, and disperse it somehow, your net worth will just keep compounding. So that's one kind of flip. But the other stage that I want to kind of talk about, especially that, is that number 5, that flexibility. And I think that you phrased it like kind of too late in life. Because when I thought about that, as you were saying it, there were kind of 3 potential examples that might come to mind. One is, so you've gone past that stability where you can maintain expenses, you're saving for the future. And that flexibility, like your income is now a little bit more. And so you could kind of have the decision of like, you could keep your expenses low where they were and save more, and you start going down that path towards FIRE, that financial independence, retire early. That because you're, even though your income has gone up, you have not increased your expenses. You've intentionally restricted, and so you're going to be financially independent sooner in life. And that's part of your intentional decision. Another part would be, okay, household income has gone up, and we could spend more because we're not trying to be financially independent before 50, before 55. We are okay making some of these life choices where it doesn't have to be working part-time per se, but like some kind of scaling back, and maybe you're not trying to be as ambitious, not trying to get as many promotions, but working career is a little easier, but you have good income and you're going to kind of keep working. And so you can increase spending there. And another example I tend to see is with dual income households, if they kind of keep their expenses manageable, but they try to live off of one income, especially when kids are still in the house, maybe they're younger, if they want to move to a one-income household. If one parent wants to stay at home with kids. That's an example of those intentional decisions that come with that flexibility stage. And so the scaling back isn't necessarily from work. It could actually be at a household level from a planning perspective. And so I think that's what I wanted to kind of talk about today would be we've talked about FIRE quite a bit in the past, and I don't want to go down that discussion too much, but that like if you were to be financially independent, you still have to restrict spending until you've gotten to that abundant wealth perspective. But if your income is going up, you're not financially independent yet, but you have no plans on retiring anyways, you have a really good savings rate, maybe you want to have one parent stay home, but if both members of a couple are still working and you have that capacity to spend a little bit more, like, how does that mentality shift? And that's the closest thing like it felt to like for me and my wife of, and I don't know when that you're not intentionally restricting as much. Like again, we're not spending frivolously. We still tend to keep a lot of the happy money things in mind of spending on experiences, trying not to buy just stuff, but when we do, we actually still do all our research. I think we're more likely to spend the time to get the best thing that will last the longest. Like we tend to focus on quality more than price. And so the highest price thing is not always the best quality or longest lasting, but we don't mind spending the extra for the thing that will last longer. And there's that, and there's also something you mentioned earlier. I forget at which stage it was most relevant, but like that idea that at one point do you really truly acknowledge and own? I think it was when you talk about that part time thing. Maybe even for yourself, like where you realize that your time is more valuable than your money, and so there are definitely things that my wife and I will pay money to save us time and that convenience part. And how long are you standing in the grocery store comparing per ounce prices? And do you find that a good use of your time versus pay the extra convenience fee to get this done faster and sooner and easier? And so when you think about like the way I phrase it from that list of like either at that flexibility stage, where they have the income, but they're not trying to be financially independent soon. That like they acknowledge they're going to continue working for the time being, so they have the extra income without it's not sacrificing savings rate at all. They're still saving very healthily. They have kind of the income, the net worth. What's the mentality there? Like, how do you feel about that versus the financial independence versus the abundant wealth versus like the time being more valuable than money?
Well, I think you brought up a good point on the flexibility level when it comes to spending. I get the feeling that at any level, you're probably faced with this question of, you know, should I spend more or save more? You know, that starts way at the beginning and it can go all the way through each level. And yeah, it's that trade-off that you kind of have to consider. And if you're looking for financial independence soon as possible, often it's going to be that sacrifice of saying, hey, save more, save more, save more. And, you know, that would be true starting at the way beginning when you're at clarity all the way up through flexibility and financial independence, even if you're aiming for abundant wealth. And, the trade-off is maybe the notion we talked about before between, you know, instant gratification or more instant happiness versus longer-term well-being. And it may be a personal decision, right? There is some research that suggests that focusing on longer term well-being may provide more sustainable happiness, more less elastic happiness, more robust happiness, maybe. So. Yeah, I think it's a question at any level. But then, yeah, as you get closer to financial dependence, maybe that there's more ability to make that trade-off and not sacrifice too much. Meaning that there's more buffer as you get closer to financial independence versus when you're, you know, earlier on on that journey. But, you know, what kind of comes to mind when this decision comes up of, you know, spending more versus saving more? It reminds me of the, that concept of humans having a tendency to kind of return to a midpoint of happiness, whatever that midpoint is for them, right?
Yeah.
Regardless of what happens in their life. This is the notion of the hedonic treadmill, right?
Yeah.
The idea that despite major positive or negative things that happen, we tend to come back to our baseline, you know, whether we win the lottery or have our leg amputated.
That was examples I remember, the lottery winners versus the amputees.
Yeah. Right, yeah. This was an earlier episode we did on happiness, but it just kind of reminds me that these trade-offs, if your baseline is at a place where you're comfortable with, then you may be comfortable making the trade-off for longer-term well-being if that has a greater potential for increasing your baseline. But then didn't I just say that it's not going to? I don't know.
I think there's something there. It actually reminds me of some of the life planning conversations, where it's not how much money do I have. I have this much money. How much can I spend? It's the inverse of this is the life I want. Here's how much it costs. So I either need to earn that much and or some combination of build my net worth up to a level to support that. So I guess not letting your money determine your spending, but letting like your spending determine how much and when. I feel like we're conflating a little too much. Like it might be inappropriate to say, this is the lifestyle I want. Here's how much it costs. So I'm not just like, oh, I want to be able to spend this much. It's like, no, try to be intentional about what is the life you actually want and work towards that. Whether it's earning more or continue working longer. But that, like, does working that much fit in that ideal lifestyle? As opposed to, okay, I got to $1 million, I can live off $30,000 a year. Okay, but I think I need to pay all my bills. Okay, my net worth grew to 1.5, so now I can live off of $35,000 a year. My net worth got, or no, $45,000 a year. My net worth got to 2 million, so now I can live off $60,000 a year. And it's like, okay, I'd like to be able to spend $10,000 a month. Okay, I need to be able to earn enough and probably save on top of that until I have enough of net worth to support that. Because that $10,000 a month is like a rough proxy for where I want to live, how much I'm spending on housing, how much I'm spending on vacations, all the other kind of food, clothes, like all the bills I think about. Like, here's the things I want to do with my time. Here's how much they cost. So I want to go skiing, and skiing is more expensive than running.
Right.
So
no, I'm curious.
Is scuba diving more expensive than golf? I don't know how much scuba diving costs.
It depends if you have your own equipment or not. So I imagine if you have your own golf equipment and you have your own scuba diving equipment, the marginal cost of golfing is your ground fees, right? Your
greens fees, yeah. Yep.
Your greens fees, at which I don't know what that is, frankly.
I'll say somewhere between $30 and $200 per round. But most of the time it would be like $50 to $80.
Okay. Time. So it's about the same then. Your marginal cost of going out scuba diving is your boat fee, which is about that much.
Okay. Does that include like refilling your oxygen tank?
Often it includes two tanks, yeah.
Okay.
For about that much, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Sorry, go on. I didn't want to interrupt you.
So, you know, actually what you say reminded me again of an earlier conversation of how happiness does tend to correlate with income up to a certain level. It's the notion that if you can cover the things you want, the more income you have up until you cover those things does actually lead to more measurable happiness. Meaning, yeah, if you're on these lower stages and you're not able to cover your own housing, your own food, your shelter, water, you know, and so on, then you will not likely be as happy as if you are on one of these higher stages where you're able to cover more. So I could actually see the correlation there, stemming all the way through financial independence. And then maybe it's not too hard to take a leap of understanding that, yeah, you might be more happy in abundance than financial independence because there's just one less thing to worry about. You don't need to zig or zag if bad things happen. You're kind of covered. Maybe that's one way to think about it.
I think that I think feels back to that stability. That's probably where that financial freedom comes from. It's like I think of that as the stability is that inflection point, that happiness inflection point, or that income happiness inflection point. So that's probably a good way to phrase it. Once you get to the stability, you see that correlation of happiness goes with income. After you get to that point, your income can go higher. It's no longer your income that's determining your happiness. It's your life decisions. It's Do you want to pursue that FIRE so you can stop working? Do you want to be a one-income household so one parent can stay at home with kids? Do you want to have a two-income household because you both find your careers fulfilling? But it's if you go down the path of we both have to work because we have to spend this much, your happiness doesn't increase. But if it's the we'd like to live this lifestyle and we both like our jobs, that's what's driving our happiness. That's probably a good way. Like, yeah, it's the after that 75,000 number, whatever, like after all the needs are met and you're saving for your future, and if nothing changed, you'll be just fine. Your income goes up above that. Your income isn't driving your happiness. It's your decisions. How does that sound? How does that feel? Like, does that jive with you?
I think it mostly does. So I agree with the part where your income goes up once you reach the stability level, or your happiness goes up with your income once you reach the stability level. I would say after that point, I'd say your happiness probably does increase, but not at the same slope, if that makes sense. Meaning it probably plateaus a bit, but there is probably a weaker positive correlation between income and happiness. And I'm speculating here, but I think it does open up more doors having being higher up. For example, there is less stress being, you know, financially independent versus being 10 years out from that, I would say. And there's probably less stress being abundantly wealthy, knowing that, you know, if you need $1 million surgery, that's covered, you know, versus not having that option, but still being financially independent.
So I think that's actually pretty close. I think you had the right example for the wrong reason. Because I don't think people go through life worrying, what if I need $1 million surgery? But I do think things like health in general become significantly more important. And it's actually another happiness factor we've talked about in the past. So like the ability to take an hour from each day to focus on health via exercising, meditation, yoga, like something along those lines. And I think that's probably where we see some of that correlation with income. Like as income goes up, it's easier to take an hour per day for your own health. Whereas if you're not earning enough, you like you need to spend that hour working. So I think that's why, like your example of that $1 million surgery, I don't think that's the abundant wealth part, because again, I don't think people are worried about that. But there is also a pretty strong correlation as income goes up, and even among the wealthier, the health outcomes and longevity both go up. That's also, again, I don't know how much causation is there, but there is definitely some correlation there as well. It would not surprise me if that lower slope of happiness increasing with income is also like happiness increasing with better health, and health increasing with better income, and probably a few other things like that.
Yeah, I'd say it opens more doors than it closes. It's, for example, the causation notion with flossing. You may have heard these individuals who floss live 7 years longer. And there's very little belief that it's actually the flossing itself that causes people to live longer. But it's a notion that if you're at the point where you're flossing in your life, you probably got many other things going for you.
Yeah. There's that you are making intentional decisions with your long-term well-being in mind.
Exactly.
You're doing the short-term uncomfortable thing with your long-term health in mind.
Right. Yeah.
And that mentality and that behavior just kind of compounds, not financially per se, but like you're also more likely to walk and go outside and more likely to have some kind of exercise regimen, and you're more likely to make sure you eat vegetables occasionally, and like all those other little things that add up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So, can you, I guess, without thinking about the hedonic treadmill idea, but can you think of something where you thought, okay, I have been restricting for my long-term well-being in mind for so long, and I'm confident that my long-term well-being is taken care of for the life I want, that now with this extra, I'm going to focus on my short-term happiness? Because there's no sacrifice on your long-term. Like, kind of, when is something that you spent money instead of saving it because you don't need to save more? Is what I'm trying to get to. But it doesn't have to be a spending money kind of thing. I'm trying, like, something that you focus, you made a short-term decision because you were confident that your long-term was taken care of.
Right. Well, it's not necessarily spending money, but it's certainly spending time. I think that was the big decision for me of just transitioning away from my career and in the hedge fund world. The notion that just didn't need to devote that much time towards my career to sustain my long-term well-being. But I think it's a little different on the spending side, because I still had this mentality of keeping the spending under control, you know, that mentality that I had with me for my entire adult life, or maybe my entire life, who knows. But I think recently it is a little different, because, you know, now that I'm thinking about or it's becoming less of a concern of managing, you know, the pennies and the dollars and cents. It is a different mindset, and it's a little harder to get comfortable with that change of being able to spend more, because it really may not matter of, you know, trying to count the pennies and cents anymore.
Yeah. So I do feel like that was kind of a cheaty answer, because I actually feel exactly the same. It was like I designed a business that I could easily do into my 60s. And right. Like, okay, if this is I don't need to retire early. Like, I'm just, if I can kind of keep this business going for a few decades, this should be the lifestyle I want. Right. Because yeah, I felt the same way. But I'm trying to think, like, what other people could take from that, other than, like, quit your job and start a business. One thing that just came to mind, like, we're going to go fly to the East Coast to see my brother and sister and their families and for 4th of July. And so we did a short trip to San Diego last month, and going through airport security with 3 kids was just slightly more painful than we expected. And so for this upcoming trip, I already had TSA pre-check, but we're going to spend the $85 so that my wife can also have TSA pre-check, so that all 5 of us can go through pre-check and hopefully make going through security at the airport just a little easier. And so, like, that's one of the things, like, yes, that's worth the $85 for 3 or 5 years, however long it lasts. Because that we should be flying more now that my youngest is old enough to do long plane flights and actually appreciate some things we're doing. I know we want to try and do enough of these things before my oldest goes off to college over the next 7 years. So again, like, I think that's why we're making the decisions with, again, focusing on experiences, But then I feel like we're spending just a little bit extra to reduce some of the stress related to those experiences.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. I think this reminds me of, I think we've mentioned this before, when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates met up for lunch, they went to a McDonald's and then they used a coupon. So you have this notion of, obviously, the two richest men on the planet are in the abundant wealth category, yet they're still making decisions that somehow curtails their spending, even though it would make absolutely no difference at all. But, you know, and I've heard this from Buffett as well. He said, you know, from his perspective, his lifestyle is very much the same as it was for, you know, I'm not going to say the average income earner, but an average, you know, semi-wealthy person. But, you know, from his perspective, he eats the same food. He lives in a very modest house. It's probably very well known that he has the same house that he's owned since for the last 30 or 40 years or whatever. But, you know, of course, he has many homes and stuff like that. But he did say one of the main differences that's probably visible is how he travels, meaning he does fly private now because he owns a private airline company. But beyond that, not too much extra spending on other things, I think likely just because it's ingrained to how he thinks about money and his relationship with it.
So at what point in your life do you think you'll spend the money for a business class or first class ticket on your flight to Asia?
It's a good question. You know, it's a lot easier if the business is paying for it, but it's a lot harder if it's your business.
I've never flown first class, never flown business class. I just don't fly enough to get, never been upgraded. So like, I can't conceptualize the difference, but I have heard from people who have, like, especially on those longer flights, the ability to lie down and sleep, like lie flat and sleep, was the big thing that they mentioned.
Yeah, that's kind of it. So the when I was a consultant when I was in a working career, the cutoff was if the flight was over 6 hours, you'd go business unless you were the CEO. Then you went first. But that was basically the difference when from upgrading. If you're doing like a red eye, you definitely want that flat seat. So that's why those business class tickets were sensible. And then you got all those points, so you could probably upgrade on your own. But you weren't really, you know, paying for it in quotes. So again, big difference than paying out of pocket for it. And yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, Aaron. I don't know. I don't know if I have a magic number in my head on when that transition happens, but I think the trade-off I go through is I would rather spend it on the destination rather than, you know, the 12-hour flight to get there. You know, I'd rather splurge on that. But then again, probably the very next point in the conversation is there's still a point where it still gets to the point where it still doesn't matter, right? You could still spend it and it would still make no difference.
I think that's part of it. Like, I had a conversation with a couple clients, both were in the situation where, like, just they kind of got lucky with the company stock and, they kind of achieved financial independence. They were close to that abundant wealth. Like, I was trying to say, one of them really loved traveling. The other one still wants to work, even though he's financially independent. And the one who loved traveling stopped working. It's like, okay, originally we'd planned like a $30,000 a year travel budget, because that's one of the things that's really important to him for his lifestyle. And I was trying to think, well, at a 3% withdrawal rate, we can easily support that. If we do like a 4% withdrawal rate, which is actually still fine based on your age, you can probably spend 50,000 to 60,000 a year on travel. Like, that difference could be flying business class or first class on those, again, international trips, going to Europe or Asia. And he had no problem with that. He's like, yes. It might be his age, maybe, because just the being more comfortable made that big of a difference. But the other ones, like, no, I can't. I'm going to be sitting working anyway. Like, that's just the way he's wired. And it's like, even on a really, really long trip, he's still going to kind of fly the cheapest ticket. And he even had, again, more of the means. So it's like, I was trying. I think that's probably the genesis of where I first brought this idea up to. It's like, when is it okay to spend more? Like, It's not like, even if you know you can, how do you give yourself permission?
It's a tough one. Yeah. You know, you did bring up a good point about age. I think that did cross my mind for a lot of the spending stuff. It's the notion that, yeah, you know, when you get older, then maybe it will be more of a, it'll be more useful to travel that way. Whereas now it doesn't make so much of a difference. And maybe that's one way to think about it. You know, I always didn't have qualms about backpacking through Europe because I realized, well, you know, I'm probably going to go through Europe again when I'm older, but it's better to backpack through Europe when you're younger, right?
Yeah.
So I guess as long as I feel like I'm not missing out, then it seems like waiting until I feel like I'm missing out on something might be a good time to switch. And I don't know when that'll be, but, you know, so, something like that.
So maybe, like, it comes back, like, yes, you need to be paying attention to income, savings, expenses, net worth. Like you've got to do all the other things first. That you can't spend frivolously until you know you're past that stability and you're now, like, onto the flexibility phase. Like, something like that. And at that point, it probably just is your own personality that you can probably do this, and it might mean that you work a few extra years. But if you like your job, then you're okay with that, then that's okay. But if you want to get out sooner or move down to one income and have a parent stay at home, like, those are also choices you can make. As long as you don't kind of get yourself stuck.
Right.
So that's why, yeah, like build up those first four stages, get to that point where you're saving consistently, manage your expenses, and as your income continues to grow, which kind of happens for every working professional in their 40s and 50s, your income's just going to keep growing. Make sure you're intentional about your life decisions, about what you actually want. And if you do want to fly business class, that's okay, because that matters to you. But if you can't see yourself spending that much money, that's okay also. Like, don't let other people tell you you should do this.
Right. No, I like that. And you did have a good earlier point in the beginning of the conversation of you do have the option to put it towards other means besides, you know, yourself. There's always charitable organizations and other ways of spending down money that could still provide a good benefit, even if it's not directly to you. It could be indirectly to you.
Yeah.
Well, that's certainly something to consider. The idea that,
that's one thing straight from the Happy Money, like donating money or donating to charitable causes or giving money to anyone. Doesn't even have to be to a charity, but giving away does increase that baseline of happiness.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for the conversation today, Trisha. I thought this was a good one.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed the conversation as well. I think it tied together a lot of our previous conversations on happiness and spending and just thinking about how these might play out over an individual's lifetime. So I enjoyed it. And if you're listening to this conversation and you have some thoughts on how these notions have played through your personal life and you want to share them, we definitely welcome hearing about it. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.